This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. We are proud to be the UK's number one and a multi-award winning legal consumer podcast. Our legal conversation today will be on rape, not guilty. I am joined by senior barrister Simon Spence KC from Red Lion Chambers in London. Simon has successfully prosecuted and defended numerous very high profile and fatal violent offences for many years. His cases have included a number of highly complex matters which have attracted national and international media attention. Simon is ranked in the Legal 500 and in Chambers and Partners. Simon, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Nice to see you, Hattie.
It's always a pleasure to record with you. There's no doubt that the statistics on rape are alarming. According to Rape Crisis, 1 in 4 women and 1 in 18 men have been raped or sexually assaulted as an adult. Being accused of rape can instantly have seriously damaging and real life-changing consequences, including the loss of your job, family and friends. So where do you stand if you have been accused of rape and not guilty? What are the steps taken by the police upon a complaint being made? How can it affect your life, including your employment or education, if you're still a student, if you have been investigated or even charged but not found guilty? In this episode, Simon and I will be bringing you the answers to the above, telling you the must-know facts and much more, as always, in plain and simple English. Simon, I was just saying, wasn't I, that the reason I want to record this episode is because I'm seeing an alarming rate of arrests being made for those that are being accused of rape, mostly teenagers and young adults in their 20s. However, either the charges are being dropped or the accused is being found not guilty. So I think it's fair to say that young adults are not well informed on this topic, and they certainly do not know what happens to them and their lives simply on a criminal accusation. So this episode will hopefully bring some seriously informative and useful information to people. Can we start by just outlining the definition of rape and what constitutes rape in our laws?
Rape is defined in the Sexual Offences Act of 2003, and it's the intentional penetration of either the vagina, the anus, or the mouth of another person by a man with his penis. And the law goes on to say that that person does not consent to the penetration, and that the man does not reasonably believe that the other person is consenting. And that word reasonable is very important because an unreasonable belief in consent still makes you guilty of the offence. And what the Act says is that in order to determine whether a belief is reasonable or not, the jury has to look to see what steps the man took in order to satisfy himself of the consent of the other party. And that's often the, if I can use the phrase, the battleground in criminal trials, because the man will be saying, well, I thought she was consenting. Yes. And she is saying, well, I didn't put up any resistance, but I wasn't consenting. I was simply submitting. And that is a really difficult matter for a jury to tackle.
Isn't it just? I mean, the fact is if somebody says, I reasonably thought there was consent, I didn't think that I was doing something that the other person was saying no to. How could, you know, it's very difficult to actually pull that apart and say, well, at that moment and at that time, because nobody can go back to that moment and time, and the majority of the time it's only two people involved.
Right.
The victim, the alleged victim, and the alleged person that's been accused. How is that even pulled apart? I mean, it must be really, really difficult.
It is. I think rape is one of the most difficult offences for the courts to deal with. And of course, there's an awful lot of talk amongst politicians about conviction rates and the statistics, criticism levelled at the Crown Prosecution Service in both directions. Cases that the public think should have been prosecuted and weren't, and cases which are brought and people think shouldn't have been brought. And the unique feature of sexual offences is, of course, by definition, they almost always happen in private. Yeah. And it's one person's word against another. And of course, because we have the presumption of innocence and the burden of proof rests on the prosecution, if you can't decide so that you're sure one way or the other, if two people is telling the truth, the inevitable result is an acquittal. And I think that is what the public sometimes find difficult to grasp.
But this is it, isn't it? It's the reasonable, you said the word reasonable, and it is the reasonable thought that somebody reasonably thought they were being given consent.
That's right.
And that's a, that, that to me says a big fat grey area, which can be determined in so many different directions, isn't it? But there you go.
Absolutely.
That's a podcast in itself, isn't it?
It is. And of course, one of the features is that somebody may consent to one form of sexual activity, but draw the line at another. And so if, you know, two people start off kissing or whatever and things progress, either the, assuming it's a female, has to say, no, I don't want to do that. And the man has to stop immediately, because if he persists, that then turns a consensual act into one of rape or some other form of sexual offence.
Yes.
But if she doesn't say no and says, well, you know, in her own mind, I don't want this to be happening, but I'm going along with it, having consented to something else previously, how is the man to know that she's not actually agreeing to what is now taking place?
Why?
And that's one of the real difficulties within the law in relation to sexual offences.
Let's talk about the immediate steps that the police would take if somebody reports that they have been raped. What's the first thing that happens to the accused, and what's the chain of events in the first 24, 36 hours?
It very much depends on the nature of the allegation. If somebody makes an allegation of rape that's occurred very recently, the first thing, of course, is that the complainant will be taken to a specialist centre, medically examined, samples will be taken, because, of course, at that stage, the police aren't going to know whether the defendant, the suspect, is going to accept that sex took place or not. And there may be forensic evidence to support whether sex did take place or not. And so with a recent allegation, that will be the very first step. And then the police would go and arrest the individual concerned and ask for an account, which obviously that person is free to give or not as they choose.
Yes.
All have a right to silence in interview. There are consequences to that at trial, of course. But if somebody makes no comment, then the prosecution still have to prove that the sexual act took place.
Well, what I'm seeing is that the police arrest some. The police will arrest the accused on rape allegations, usually in the dead of the night or when they're in their employment. That's what I have seen in the last few years.
Yes.
And they will. They won't question that person straight away. It will be hours, sometimes as much as 20 hours plus, before they actually question that person. And what I would say to anybody that's been accused is make sure, absolutely make sure, that you have some legal representation and you talk through your side of the story with your legal representation before you go and into that interview room and decide whether you're going to give an interview or whether you're not. But it's what, you know, it's a very distressing time for somebody to be arrested all of a sudden, particularly if they don't believe they've done, especially if they don't believe they've done anything wrong. It's a shock to their system mentally, and it can be physically, because you're often in a cell, as I said, for many, many hours before you're even questioned.
Well, that's right. And of course, one of the other complaints that's been made recently is the delays in, particularly in rape cases, actually, coming to court. And this probably isn't the time to be talking about the backlog in the Crown Court and the effect of COVID and so on and so forth. But the police are massively overstretched. And of course, if they arrest somebody in relation to a rape allegation, the chances are that person will be released on bail or released under investigation rather than remanded into custody. It's quite rare for people charged with rape, unless they've got previous convictions, to be remanded into custody. And so automatically their case doesn't take priority over custody cases. And that's why we're getting cases now which are 3 or 4 years old before they even come to trial. That, of course, it puts a huge burden on the defendant. But also, of course, it means that the complainant is awaiting the opportunity to give her evidence for a very, very long time. And there have been cases where a complainant has simply declined to continue cooperating with the police because of the delay. And they say, you know, it's too much for my mental health. And either way, justice isn't being served, because once an allegation is made, it should be tried and a jury make a decision about it. And so there are legitimate concerns, I think, about the way in which sexual offences are dealt with by the police and the courts.
Absolutely. I mean, you can be detained, just on the question of detention, you can be detained for 24 hours, or sometimes that can be extended to 36 for questioning. Yeah. So that's the maximum time you can be kept in a police cell without being charged with something, or either released on bail or released on investigation. It is a very, very trying process for somebody that's been accused. And, you know, we talk about being interviewed after being held for hours and hours and hours, and often being taken in the dead of the night. So the accused is likely to be really distressed, anxious, upset, confused even. We said 24 to 36 hours, but can they be held longer, or what? I mean, bail is 3 to 6 months and then it can be extended. Are there time limitations where the police just cannot go on saying we're still investigating?
Well, this is due to
their own backlog of work. That's right.
Yeah. And of course, this is one of the problems. Being released under investigation, as opposed to being released on bail, doesn't carry with it an end date. If somebody's released by the police on bail, they're bailed to a particular date, to return to the police station, either to be charged or further interviewed or to be told no action's being taken. If someone's released under investigation, there is no return date. And so the case just drags on and on and on, with the police not feeling or under any great pressure to bring the case to a conclusion. And that is a criticism that's made by the courts.
That's a really important point, Simon, and I think one that should be made absolutely clear. You know, so if you're out on bail, there's a deadline. The police have a deadline to bring you back, as you say, for further questioning, to either extend your bail or to end your bail and say no further action's been taken. Whereas if the police just release you on and say we're investigating this, it could go on for months, and if not year or over a year, as we're seeing in some cases where the police are still investigating, but the police are not under any, as you say, pressure to end the investigation because there's no deadlines to it, even though, you know, goodness, I mean, it is really, really trying, as you say, on both, on the alleged victim, but on somebody that's been accused of rape, but subsequently, let's say, you know, charges are not being brought against them for whatever reasons a CPS may have, lack of evidence, or they just don't believe, you know, what happened actually occurred. So what happens to that person's record with the police? And really importantly, what happens to that person's DBS record, you know, the disclosure and barring service, does the fact that they were not accused, sorry, they were accused but not charged, remain in a system somewhere? And I want to talk about this because this, I think, is really important, simply because of the impact it has on somebody's life when these things, an investigation, and we're only talking about investigation here, has been made and carried out, a criminal investigation.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things with rape, that there is a unique stigma to the offence of, or any sexual offence, whether it be rape or any other form of sexual allegation. And even if it doesn't result in a conviction, I think there's this feeling of there's no smoke without fire. And of course, the other unique aspect, or almost, that it applies to blackmail as well, is that whilst the defendant can be named and identified, there is automatic anonymity for a complainant. And
that's
so,
a big controversial area.
It's a very controversial area.
Isn't it?
Of course, it does mean, if somebody is of a particular state of mind, that they can make an allegation which they know is false, but knowing that they are safe insofar as their own identity is concerned, but they can try and blacken the name of somebody for perhaps an entirely different motive by making a false allegation of rape against them. And I'm not for a moment suggesting that's common by any means, but it is a fact of life.
Yes,
somebody
I've seen it, Simon. I've seen it in more than one case. I've seen it, and this is I'm seeing more of it, and this is what's worrying, you know.
Well, it is, and I think as young people become more aware, and they can almost use it as a form of weapon, if you like, to say, well, if you don't do what I say, I'm going to make an allegation against you. And I've dealt with some cases myself where evidence has been uncovered where effectively somebody is trying to blackmail somebody else by threat of making an allegation of sexual assault. I did one case.
As you say, where, it could be a certain state of mind as well. I mean, it might
absolutely.
Be, you know, they're not of sound mind and they're just in a self-destructive, whatever I can do to get at the other person. And what's one of the, you know, not easiest, but it's not difficult. I could go to a police station and accuse somebody of rape if I've spent the night with them.
That's the thing. There is a move afoot at the moment to try and change the law yet again and effectively reverse the burden of proof in relation to consent, which I think would be a very dangerous step indeed for a whole variety of reasons. But it would increase the potential for false allegations to be made and motivated by some other reason rather than the fact it's a genuine complaint. But I think the public are becoming more aware, more forensically aware, and I think that is causing some difficulties. And I've dealt with a number of cases, both in the recent past and not so recent past, where allegations have been made for reasons entirely separate from the fact that actually somebody was indeed raped. I had one case where a sister had been cut out of a will and effectively said to her brother, unless you get me put back onto the will, their parents' will, I am going to make an allegation against you. And this emerged very shortly before the trial was due to take place, and the case collapsed. And we're going to go on
to speak about what happened, you know, what can somebody do if they have been falsely accused and, you know, the effect that it has on their lives? Because you've got, where does it stay? Well, you've got the Police National Computer, also known as the PNC, and the DBS here, your DBS record is so key to your employment, particularly if you're working with children, vulnerable adults, or in an environment where the police think it's actually in an employer's best interest to know that you have been investigated for something. Because, you know, they hold details of convictions, cautions, reprimands, warning arrests, and it stays on the Police National Computer. The investigation would likely stay on there until your 100th birthday, which means really for life.
Yes.
That's a serious thing.
Yes, and of course there are different levels of DBS checks depending on whether it's an advanced or an enhanced, I think is the word that they use, an enhanced check or a standard check. And my understanding is that if it's an enhanced check, then arrest that doesn't lead to a conviction remains there.
Yes.
And even though, as a matter of fairness, you'd think somebody should put that out of their mind, in reality, if you're looking to offer a job to somebody, for example, and you've got one person who's been arrested for a sexual offence but never prosecuted for it, and someone else who hasn't, naturally, you're going to go with the person who hasn't been arrested.
But this is what's worrying, Simon. This is what I've seen. I've seen young adults being investigated for these offences, charges not being brought, but it stays on the enhanced DBS check because you've got the basic DBS standard enhanced, and you've got one even higher than the enhanced called the enhanced with barred lists. But an investigation, sexually related criminal investigation, it stays on somebody's enhanced DBS check. And I think that is, you know, how do you make this fair? Because yes, I get it. You're trying to protect employers, people, the wider public, but where does the line get drawn to say, well, this was an investigation and charges were not brought? Why should an investigation stay on somebody's enhanced DBS check? Do you think that's
well? I don't. I agree with you entirely. It's a really difficult balancing act, isn't it? Because on the one hand, we do want a system that encourages people who are genuinely offended against sexually to come forward and feel safe and protected to make a complaint.
And you also want to be able to protect yourself as society against anybody that maybe is having constant allegations but not being found guilty because of a lack of evidence, or maybe the victim isn't, you know, is withdrawing, as you say, withdrawing their complaints. Mm. So how can the line be drawn? I think it needs to delve in deeper. And I think that, I get it, it's all down to resources. And I think that it can't be that there was an investigation. Why was the charges dropped?
Well, absolutely. I mean, certainly in relation to a DBS check, if somebody isn't proceeded against, or if they're tried and acquitted, then I think there needs to be on that record something that explains why, so that anybody who's evaluating a DBS check can fully understand what's gone on.
Let's just be clear here. If an employer asks for your enhanced DBS check, which is, you know, likely in a lot of working environments, and they see that you've been investigated for rape, they will likely tell you that you can't be employed for the position. Definitely if you're working with children, vulnerable people, and also there's all sorts of environments we shall say, I'm very sorry, but we can't even offer you a job. That's why we're going on and banging on about this whole DBS check thing, because it's so important. It changes your life. Even in education, some educational institutes will ask for DBS checks for young adults. And that's where your life just completely changes. You could lose your career, your job, what you've been working for, simply because you've been investigated but not found guilty, or charges have not even been brought. Because it's my understanding that if you go to court, if the trial goes to court and you're not found guilty, then it will go on your CRB check, which is a Criminal Records Bureau.
That's right.
You know, so that's another one. That's a third space.
Yes. It is a really difficult issue, and I think it's one that needs tackling, although I fear there's probably very little political appetite to do anything about it. I think, to be honest, it all comes back to not just resources, but proper training, both for police officers. There's obviously a specialist rape and serious sexual offence unit within the Crown Prosecution Service.
Yes.
And in my profession as a barrister, you have to have undertaken particular training to be able to prosecute cases of this type. You don't have to do it to defend them. And I think that's a big gap in the training programme. It seems to me that defending in sexual cases, particularly when you're cross-examining a potentially vulnerable victim, whether it be adult or child, It needs doing with considerable care. And whilst there's a requirement on somebody to have gone through the training to prosecute, whilst it's encouraged for defence, it's not compulsory. And I've seen some truly shocking cross-examinations of rape complainants, and particularly of children, where the method of cross-examination is so inappropriate. And it does seem to me, from top to bottom, starting with the police who first investigate a case, all the way through to the trial process, people need training properly in how to deal sensitively and appropriately with these types of cases, because they are unique cases. And for me, I think they're uniquely difficult. You know, you mentioned in the introduction, I do an awful lot of homicide cases, which I do, far more than sexual cases. But actually, because the victim by definition is dead and you don't cross-examine them, defending or prosecuting a murder case is much easier than prosecuting or defending a sexual offences case.
We talk about training and having the legal system. We talk, you know, from lawyers right up to the police force, CPS, to be trained and everything else. But do you think that the law adequately protects somebody that's been accused as well as the accuser, the alleged victim? Do you think that, because I think there's a big gap. I think there's lots of gaps there. Mm. Where people that are being accused who are not guilty, and I'm talking about those that are not guilty, genuinely not guilty, and only two, I always say only God knows and they know sometimes, but sometimes it does come out as absolutely, underlyingly, blatantly true that they were not guilty of a rape offence. Do you think the law adequately provides for them? Because when we go on to say, right, they were investigated, they were told that charges were not going to be brought. I mean, the reality is that investigations can go on for months and months and months. And somebody that's been accused of rape has to literally, in some shape or form, and some are affected more than others, put their whole life on hold, was often resulting in them losing their job or being asked to leave their education facility and much more. So if charges are not brought against the accused, or they were, you know, charged and not found guilty, let's talk about the actions that the accused can take against the alleged victim for basically, in some cases, ruining their life by coming out and saying, you know, making this accusation.
It's very difficult.
I can think of a few.
Yes. And the only recourse for somebody who is falsely accused is to make a complaint against their accuser of either wasting police time or attempting to pervert the course of justice.
Defamation. But of course,
there's defamation as well in the civil courts, but in the criminal courts, it's very difficult. The trouble is, because the burden of proof is on the prosecution, if the jury have a doubt, then they acquit. That by acquitting, they're not necessarily saying we disbelieve the complainant. All they're saying is we can't be sure. And that being the case, it's then very difficult, except in the most blatant of cases where you've got evidence that somebody has deliberately made a false allegation.
And they're the ones I'm talking about, Simon. I'm talking about the blatant cases where the one you mentioned earlier with the sister and the brother, where evidence came out that she basically said to him, if you don't put me back on that will, I'm going to the police to make an accusation against you. I'm talking about those cases where we have uncovered that it is a lie, that the accusation is a lie. There is no doubt that this didn't happen in the form that the alleged victim is saying it did. You know, defamation, I understand that's in the civil courts and you can go there. If your reputation has been damaged as a result of, you might have lost your job, you might be a teacher, for example, you may never be able to go back into teaching again because it's going to sit on your enhanced DBS check that you've been investigated or whatever. It could be another area of work where you lose your career. Mm. You can no longer go, you know, or your peers find out, your workplace finds out, and all of a sudden your whole life is just turned upside down. False allegations, you know, you can sue personally somebody for that, but the wasting police time and perverting the course of justice is when someone was actually sentenced. They were found guilty based on somebody else's lives.
Well, it could be that, or it could be, and I did actually do one case where this happened, where a defendant was acquitted, and he then took a private prosecution out against his complainant for attempting to pervert the course of justice. Now, of course, private prosecutions are very rare, and the Crown Prosecution Service always have the power to take them over.
And we're just talking about private criminal prosecutions. We've done
yes, that's right.
Podcasts no. on that. I've got two podcasts. That's a very interesting area of law.
Yeah. The problem with defamation, of course, is that it's very, very expensive because it has to be in the High Court, and it has to be privately funded. There's no legal aid available for defamation.
Well, the most recent one that the public will probably, that we all won't ever forget, is the Wagatha Christie trial, which was between
absolutely
Colleen Rooney and Rebecca Vardy, and that was a defamation case.
Yes, that's right.
Colleen was a defendant, and she actually won the case.
But the costs in that were eye-watering.
A few million pounds. And they were high profile, and it was all very...
Yes, that's right. You know, but the thing is, if you're an ordinary working man who has a false allegation made against them, you're not really going to have the resources to sue somebody for defamation. And even if you succeed and get your name cleared, you know, you're still left with a very large bill. And so it is very difficult for anybody to have recourse to the courts to clear their name. And it comes back to what I was saying earlier, that sexual offences do carry a stigma to them in a way that I don't think any other offences do. And that is the primary problem with the topics that we've been discussing. And it's a completely separate topic from the conviction rate, which is what a lot of people focus on. Because
it's important, isn't it, Simon? I mean, we're talking about if you've been accused of rape and you're not guilty and it's categorically been proven, or you have evidence to say that. That's what we're saying here. You know, and if somebody's gone and falsely accused you and wasted police time in doing that, you know, in the Criminal Law Act actually has a provision for that, that the police can actually sue you. Now, we're saying the police don't have the time to investigate the complaints that, you know, are flowing through the doors, and they're overworked and they don't have enough time. But the police can actually look at, you know, bringing action against somebody. Perverting the course of justice, again, is in the criminal courts. You could take private criminal prosecution, which, again, is not cheap. It can be expensive. You know what? You can do your homework and you can bring the action yourself in defamation or in any of those, really, because lots of people ask this, where the cases I've dealt with is that categorically it's been proven that it did not happen. And there was other, in quite a few cases, other motives for the allegations. And people say, what can I do about it? My life's been ruined. And you, as you said earlier, that person, the alleged victim doesn't get anything said about them anywhere.
No.
They made the allegation. You know, there is no balance here for that person that's been accused that wasn't guilty.
No, that's right. I mean, there is a school of thought, and I can see some force to the argument, that in the event of somebody being acquitted, that the complainant should lose their right to anonymity, and the judge should have a discretion as to whether to release the name of that person into the public domain. Now, again, that doesn't happen, I suspect, because the view is taken that that would discourage genuine complainants to make a complaint. But it does seem to me that that would go some way to restoring the balance that we've been talking about between protecting the rights of a complainant on the one hand and preserving her privacy, but equally providing some form of recompense to an acquitted defendant. Because if somebody makes a false allegation knowingly, and they know that at the end of it, if the jury acquit, they are at risk of being named and shamed, if I can put it that way, that somebody who's going to make a false complaint may actually pause and think twice about it. If someone's making a genuine complaint, they're not going to worry about it, because they're going to assume they'll be believed because they're telling the truth, and the jury will convict. And whilst we don't have a perfect system, and there are people who are convicted of any sort of criminal offence who didn't actually commit it, And equally, we have a lot of people who are acquitted who are in fact guilty. That's simply the way the system works. But if somebody's anonymity
that's what
is
I'm saying. There's a gap. There's a gap there.
Yeah.
It's not an easy answer to any of it, because like you rightly say, you know, the law has to protect any victim in any circumstance if it's genuine and it's real. I 100% believe in that. And it has to encourage people to come forward to actually make the complaint rather than be afraid of the system is going to backfire. But at the same time, I think that we owe the same duty to somebody who's been falsely accused to be able to be protected, to be able to get, at least get on with their lives. And with the current system, you know, most people can't just get on with their lives because it affects their public, their records that employers can get hold of, that family and friends can get hold of, you know. And that brings us back to the question. If you are accused of rape, do you by law have to disclose that to your employer?
Not unless it is a job that requires the sort of DBS checks we've been talking about.
Yes.
What most job applications do is you have to disclose whether you've got any criminal convictions. And if you've been tried and acquitted, or if you've been charged and then the case has been dropped, there's no obligation on you to disclose that fact in a general job application to an employer.
Well, why should employment? I mean, there might be, there probably will be in an employment contract something that says that you need to disclose any criminal investigation that may be carried out on you. I mean, I don't know whether most employment contracts cover that or not, but I think there may be a clause saying that you're obliged to tell your employer if you're being investigated, because it's a criminal investigation at the end of the day. It's not a civil matter. As long as it's obviously outside of your workplace, are you legally obliged? No, but go back to your employment contract and check that and see whether if you gave an enhanced DBS to your employer upon taking your job application, then it's probably likely that you do have to disclose it because it will show up on that as an investigation.
Absolutely. But anybody who's in that position would need to look very carefully at the job application that they're making just to see what the terms are.
Or their employment contract if they're in employment. No, absolutely.
Certainly in my experience, and my experience of employment law is very limited, generally speaking, you're only asked to disclose convictions. And not cases that resulted either in an acquittal or which didn't go ahead.
Yes.
And it does seem to be very unfair that an employer who is looking to employ somebody where you're not concerned with vulnerable adults or children, what you've been up to in the past is really neither here nor there.
I've seen people lose their jobs. I've seen, obviously, teachers lose their jobs being accused of rape whilst in investigation. I've seen somebody who actually works in the health and safety environment lose their job while they're being investigated because their job was to go into other people's homes to carry out health and safety checks. So they were not allowed to go into it. The employer said, we can't allow you into the public domain and into other people's homes while you're being investigated for such a crime, basically. So I've seen people lose all types of jobs. You know, relationships fall apart, friends, you know, say, right, you keep our distance simply because they're being investigated or they have been investigated.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I can understand whilst an investigation's ongoing that an employer has to protect their own position.
Yeah.
But once the case is over, if it doesn't result in a conviction, then it shouldn't,
be held against. People lose their careers and have to change it because it stays on their enhanced DBS. We go back to that. Why is that important? It stays there. An employer cannot hire anybody that's got anything criminally linked to even an investigation, even though without charge, on their enhanced DBS. And that's why it changes people's lives. And I think that for young adults or anybody really, you know, you don't have to be a young adult to be informed on this topic. It's really important to get an understanding of how big it can be to just be accused and investigated if you're not guilty.
Absolutely. Yes. No, I agree 100% with that. I at some stage, I do think it's a topic that needs to be addressed and the rules made clear to try and get rid of that stigma, which I
Yes.
spoke about earlier. Because there is this overwhelming temptation for people to think that there is no smoke without fire, and that if an allegation is made, then somehow or other it must be true, without being investigated properly. And it seems to me that's the real danger with, particularly with allegations of rape.
Indeed, indeed. Simon, that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Another cracking episode. And what I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. We have over 160 to choose from. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.